Well, time is here, so I think I better get started. Go ahead and start the tape rolling. I'm John Brand. I like to start all of my discussions, but first of all, let me tell you what we're doing this. I'll be here for 3 days, I think. And many years ago, I came across an article by Dr. Hellick, who at that time was head of psychiatry at the University of Wisconsin Medical School. And he simply listed 10 things, that 10 questions, 10 ideas that a maturing person has to digest and think about in order to achieve some level of maturity, wisdom, whatever it is. And what we're doing these next 3 days, we're going to go through some of these values that Hellick projected for us. And because some of the things that I'll be saying are very radical and right on the edge of some really new knowledge, and might prove to be somewhat, maybe even difficult to digest. I like to begin all of my series with some quotations that I think have some real significance. The first one is by William James, and he said, "The greatest revolution in our generation is the discovery that human beings, by changing the inner attitudes of their minds, can change the outer aspects of their lives." Now, this was written before the atomic bomb and all that sort of thing, but I think even if he had been here and the atomic bomb was set off and we discovered, you know, laces and all that sort of thing, I still think that William James would not have changed this statement, that we can find more liberty and more freedom and change the outer aspects of our lives by changing the inner perceptions that we hold. And obviously some perceptions that human beings hold, that you and I hold, are not exactly the most correct ones or the best ones or the most uplifting and maturing ones. We believe things that are not very correct. We just, human beings have always done that, and later on today I'll give you an example of that. I like Alan Watts's quotation. He makes the difference between belief and faith. Belief, as I use the word, he is the insistence that the truth is what we leave it to be or wish it to be. The word leave means to wish. The believer will open his mind to the truth on the condition that it fits in with his preconceived ideas and wishes. Faith, on the other hand, is the undeserved opening of the mind to the truth, whatever it turns out to be. Faith is not afraid of truth. Belief is. Faith has no preconception. It is a plunge into the unknown. Belief clings. Faith lets go. In this sense of the word, faith is the essential virtue of science, and likewise of any religion that is not self-deceptive. It's an important quotation. And my experience, as I attempted to grow a little bit in life and become a little bit wiser, and the last one of Herbert Spencer, which one of my students gave me, "There is a principle which is a bar against all information, which is a proof against all arguments, and which cannot fail to keep a man in everlasting ignorance. That principle is contempt prior to investigation." Let me share with you at this point something I hadn't planned to do, but it pops into my mind. Probably the most serious thing that the human mind has to fight is something I call Ptolemy's folly. Now, Philip, you know who Ptolemy was. He was a 2nd century astronomer whose influence extended into the Copernican age and into Kepler's age. So for 1300 years, I mean, what he told us about astronomy held sway. Now, anybody can influence the human mind for 1200 years. It's got to be a brilliant human being. And as I understand, some of his basic system of sizing stars or doing something in the systematizing stars and heavens, it lays the foundation of modern ways of doing this sort of thing. This was a genius. This was a guy who, you know, went past the first grade in school. He's just a brilliant human being. But, like all geniuses, he did a very, very stupid thing. Aristotle, Plato, Socrates, all believed that God is absolutely perfect. And they believe that an absolutely perfect God reveals himself in absolute perfect geometric figures. And the most perfect of all geometric figures is what?
The circle.
The circle. So when they looked out at the heavens and they saw the planets, they said that all planetary orbits must be circular in nature, because God made them, and God is perfect, and God reveals himself in perfection. Well, Ptolemy was a very astute observer of the heavens, and he realized that the planetary orbits are not circular in nature. They're elliptical. But he made this a priori assumption. He's exactly what Spencer says, that he had contempt, if you will, prior to investigation. He had to prove, because to him God was perfect and revealed himself in perfect circles. So he had to prove that the planetary orbits are circular. So he invented what doctrine? He invented the doctrine of epicycles. And what epicycles are, he said, well, what happens is this. Here is a perfect circle, and this is the, assume I drew it correctly, a perfect circle. This is a perfect circle, and what God has done is he had little epicycles. These are little cycles that are perfect circles that are tangential to the big circle, and as the planet makes its path through these perfect circles to an observer on Earth, it seems as though it is an elliptical circle. So what Ptolemy did, he proved a false assumption with erroneous proof. And I submit to you that some of that still goes on today, and part of our anxieties and part of our fears and part of our guilt feelings are simply trying to defend something that ain't so. Okay? Now, that too shocking? But I hope you will have an open mind, whether you agree with me or not. You know, that is not the issue. The issue is to keep an open mind. Now, today, we shall take, hopefully, the first two of Halleck's values. And, I didn't know what to name this thing. I said significant issues, but I mean, that's, you know, just, it's just trying to come to grips with some values, some things that we as human beings, that's some more coming from the other side, so need to, here's the next one. Now, the first one, he says, and I understand that this man is not a theologian. And by the way, let me share with you one of my very profound convictions. That there is no such thing as Christian theology, nor is there such a thing as Jewish theology, or Muslim theology, or Hindu theology, or any theology to which you attach some religious noun in front of it. What does theology mean? Well, theo, of course, means God. And logos means knowledge. So theology is the knowledge about God, right? As soon as I put the word Christian in front of it, what am I doing?
Subjective. Being subjective.
Yes, I'm circumscribing the study of God with certain a priori assumptions that come from the New Testament, from the history of from the writings of the Patristic Fathers, church history, Martin Luther in your case, John Wesley in my case, but we are committed to certain a priori findings. And I'm saying when you have a priori commitments, you must talk in terms of dogmatism and not in terms of theology. Now, there are probably no decent theologians would agree with me on that, but I'm simply sharing with you something that I believe. A theologian must be free to accept new revelations about God. He must be free to look at shale, like you did in the previous hours, and to say, oh wow, you know, when I look at the shale and the sandstone and all these formations of the Grand Canyon, I must be free to put this in juxtaposition to the statement, God made the world in 6 days, rested the seventh. I must be free when I look at the infinity of space, if there is such a thing, whatever space might be, we don't know. Foggy's idea what it is, basically. But when I look at that, I must be free to put this information, this new information about light years. Does anybody understand what a light year is, Philip? I mean, do they really conceive it? I mean, is anybody can conceive it?
Well, not tangibly, no.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, you know, we can put it down as the light travels 165 miles a second for 365 days, but, you know, what does that mean? I mean, it just, okay, we've got to take that concept, even though we don't understand it or can tangibly get a hold of it, against our understanding of God. And the more we delve into the world from a observational point of view, instead of revelation of 2,000 and 3,000 years ago, we must be free to incorporate that, or we're going to wind up with an erroneous image of God. That's my position. Okay? So, I think of myself as a theologian and not a dogmatist. Of course, theologians would disagree with that. I mean, that's their privilege, and it's my privilege to disagree with them. I'm retired. I have independent income, so I don't depend upon anybody. That gives you a tremendous amount of freedom, okay? I mean, Social Security and your little retirement free from the church is still an independent income. So anyway, the first thing that Alex, this is something that certainly is very, very dogmatic from the Christian point of view. There's ample scientific, strong scientific evidence that without some capacity to share strong feelings of affection with another person, it is not possible to lead a happy or useful life. Now, that's quite a profound statement for psychiatrists to make. Now, in Christianity, we would call this strong feeling of affection. What would we call it? It's left to us. To me, besides Jesus' self-sacrifice, the strongest evidence of affection for another person is the story of Hosea. That's just an unbelievable story. God comes to this prophet and says, I want you to teach the people of Israel a lesson. I want them to understand just how unlimited and unconditional my love is. And because these people are so dense and they don't understand abstract thinking. Now, God didn't say all that, but I think he said all that to Abraham, to Hosea in some way or another. He said, I want you to go out and I want you to marry Gomer. Now, everybody in Shalane knew that Homer was a prostitute. I mean, Gomer was a prostitute. Everybody knew that. And Hosea said, wow, Lord, you know, you're kind of bugging me about this sort of thing. And God said, no, I want you to teach the people of Israel a lesson of unconditional acceptance. Marry her. And Hosea said, okay. And he married Gomer. Now, what is it that God tried to say through Hosea? That my love for you, Israel, is total and unconditional. And no matter how much you have screwed up, you can't get past my love. This prostitute, from a moralistic point of view, is no good. She is a sinner. We'll stone her to death, you know, all this kind of stuff. And I want the people to know that my love is so strong that nothing, not even prostitution, stands between you and my love for them. And when the people didn't understand this, you know, hey, most of us don't understand a lot of things. God turned to Hosea and he said, I want you to marry an adulteress. Same thing. Bad woman, evil, no good, sinful, condemned, good enough to be stoned to death. And God tried to show us here that it is unconditional love that lies at the heart of all creative relationships. Now, how many, you know, the problem is, you know, is how can we get to unconditional love? How many of you were here? I want to repeat myself to too many of you. Heard me talk about this unconditional love and the story of limitations and all this sort of thing. I don't think any of you were here last week to hear me do that. There were real few. Let me, if you've heard it, it won't hurt you. You can go to sleep, okay? and it won't bother me. How can we learn to love unconditionally? That's a tough thing. As a matter of fact, Ruhl Hauff says that love on the horizontal is totally impossible. Ruhl Hauff, many years ago, back in the 50s, I think, wrote a book called The Miracle of Dialogue, and I don't think anything better has been written since then about communication. Ruhl Hauff says, love on the horizontal, communication on the horizontal, me, you, is totally impossible. I cannot love you. Why? Yeah, I've got so many preconceived ideas. I've got so many expectations that I have of you. I will run home to hear me talk. Hell, if you don't, you don't love me. I mean, that doesn't make sense. I mean, it makes perfect sense, doesn't it? I mean, we have these desires, we have these wishes, we have these projections. It's true in a marriage, isn't it? I mean, your husband or your wife is pulling some dumb stunts every once in a while that you don't understand and you don't expect, and they're just weird. And so we let these, that is, present people accept it. Okay, nobody here has that fun. I mean, other people on the outside have that. So rural house is a very simple thing. Yeah. It's simple to read, to understand. It's easy to teach this, you know, to people who have a religious background. More difficult, but it can be done. This guy used different language. We all believe that above all things, God does what to me? What does he? He loves me. What's the little song the children sing in Sunday school? Jesus loves me. This I know. Yeah, okay. All right. You know, we know that, but do we really think what that means? From a theological point of view, there are a lot of reasons that I can think of why God shouldn't love me. I can think of all sorts of things that I have done, all sorts of nasty little thoughts I've had, all sorts of, you know, a mile long, why God would be, from a logical point of view, would be perfectly justified in saying, John, I do not have to love you. But Christian affirmation, this is about the only really wonderful, uniquely different thing about the Christian faith, as far as I'm concerned, is that we make this proclamation that God loves you. You don't deserve it. And I say, wow, this is great, you know. Sure. Thank you, God. Wonderful. Then I take a deep breath and I says, now wait a minute. Surely, God, you don't mean that you're going to love this person over here. He's bad. I mean, he is so different from the way I am. I mean, he's bad. God, don't you know that? And God says, no. I love him too. Now that's what, you know, that's the shocking news about the Christian message, that God loves this guy over here. So then I take a look at this triangle and I say, well, there's no way that I can love this guy. I'm not God. No way can love him. No way. Unless. I say, okay, God, by you loving me, you have in a sense taken the monkey off my back. That's what it means for God to love you. Whatever monkey you have on your back, whatever this is, the burden, the anxiety, the guilt, the stress, the past, all the crud that happens to us in life, it's a lot. It's faith. And he says, you know, if I love you, won't you have it, you know, in you to love me? And I don't mean go to church every time the doors open. I don't mean all this stuff that the church has said you must do. That's not. Read Amos. Read Amos. And read what Jesus says about church going. I'm not against church going. Don't misunderstand me. I made my living that way. But I would preach these kind of messages to my people. This is not the important thing. You're sitting in this cotton picking pew at 11 o'clock on Sunday morning. I want you to be in here, my wonderful words of wisdom. But that ain't it. And for our choir to sing all these pretty songs, and for the organist to do all these crescendos and all this stuff that you just lifts the sky high, that ain't it. What's it? Is that, okay, God, you love me. Now, what through you must I do? And God doesn't say, you've got to go to sacraments, and you've got to, you know, do this, and you've got to tithe, and you've got to do that, and you've got to agree with everything Martin Luther said, which would be an impossibility. I finished a course on Luther not too long ago, and I mean, you know, he said all kinds of things. You know. No, that's not it. I want you to love
your neighbors
yourself. It's that simple, that complicated. Now, how do you get to love yourself? See, that's the issue, isn't it? So many of us have a hard time with really accepting ourselves. And I said in some course, and if I repeat myself, please forgive me, that Jesus never talked about forgiveness. Never, never, ever did he talk about forgiveness. Now I see you looking rather quizzical. He talked about something far more fundamental than forgiveness. And the thought occurred to me when I read this story about Peter and Jesus. Now, in order to understand the story, you've got to know a little bit something about the Old Testament ways. The Old Testament, the Jewish law, said that you had to forgive another person three times. Okay? So I'm here, and you do something to me. Numero uno. I'm not going to do anything because the law says, John, got to be a good boy. Numero dos. Take a deep breath, boy, it's hard. Three times. And I'm waiting for you to do it the fourth time, brother. Because the law says when you do it four times, I can throw the book at you all the way. That's what the law said. Forgive three times, four times. No, you don't have to give any longer. So Peter asked Jesus, he said something like this. Jesus, I've been listening to all this stuff you've been saying, and I want you to know that I'm a good student. I'm going to ask you a question. How often must a man forgive? And before he gave Jesus a chance to answer, he said, seven times? I'm a big boy, and I'm going to hold my breath, and I'm going to hold my tongue for seven times. I'm a little book. I'm going to keep track of everybody. Ruby, you better watch it. Yours are number six right now. So I'm going to put down a little black mark, and when it gets to number seven, and that's more than anybody can bear, I should be entitled. When number eight rolls around on the computer, that boy, I'm going to throw the book at you. And you know, Jesus could be very sarcastic. He used sarcasm any number of times. And he said, oh, Peter, 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 will you ever learn? You're just like the rest of them. You must forgive 70 times 7. Now, am I going to sit behind my computer and punch in a little blip every time you do something wrong to me and until I get to number 491? Well, of course not. That's dumb, okay? So what Jesus was talking about is not forgiveness. He was talking about acceptance. Acceptance. I don't know what's inside of your lives. You don't know what's in mine. Sometimes I don't know myself what's in my life, deep down inside, right? So how can I not accept you? I may not like, what you're doing. And some people are obnoxious, right? Aren't they? Sure they are. And you got to take a real deep breath, but you still have to accept them. Now, still we come back to the original question. How can I accept myself? How do I really behaviorally, from a profound, and I don't draw distinction between, in this sense, between spiritual, psychological, emotional, this is all one schmear as far as I'm concerned. From a significant point of view, how can I accept myself? Now, I become a little bit Freudian here, and I think one of the real sad things is that we have lost some of the impetus that Freud gave to self-understanding. Freud had some very significant things to say, and along come other psychiatrists, and of course, like any pioneer, he's going to say some things that aren't right. After all, Columbus thought that he discovered China. he didn't. But that didn't take away from his creativity and his discovery of the New World. So any pioneer is going to say some things that are proven wrong. A lot of stuff that Freud said is silly, but a lot of things said are very significant. I do believe that a lot of significant things happen to us when we're very, very small. There's a lot of imprinting that goes on when we're little babies. And let me share with you something that I sort of wrestled with and came up with. And it's helped some people, so maybe it'll help some of you, I don't know. But I firmly believe before I can love you, I've got to love myself. I really believe that. Before I accept you, got to accept myself. So, we know this. Here's a little baby, okay? And the little baby is hungry, and what does the little baby do? It cries, and what happens? Okay, and who feeds it most of the time? mother in the early stages, or some female authority figure, right? Comes along and feeds the baby, and the baby says, wow, this is great. This is wonderful. Great. Life is simple. Nothing to it. You're hungry, you cry, somebody comes, gives you a bottle, or nurses you, whatever. And so the little baby, a little bit later on, gets cold, like he's in Holden. And so he does what? Or she does what? Cries. And what happens?
Stick a bottle in the mouth.
Now we're cold. We're cold, David. Get with it. Come on.
You got to train your parent first before that.
No. I think the parent will put a blanket over the little kid. I mean, you really are. So the mother comes. Again, it's a female figure for most of us. And puts a blanket over us. And then, you know, a little bit later on, the kid just gets unhappy. This diaper is wet. Okay? And he cries. Mother comes, right? Changes the diaper. And what does the kid learn? This is a learning process, you know. We learn from the moment the doc slaps us on the back and we take our first breath. It's a learning process. And what do we learn?
Crying works.
Crying works. And who satisfies my needs?
Mama.
So, now, this is abstract, but just so I can picture it. Here is 100% of my needs as a little tiny baby. And my needs are satisfied. They're very simple at that stage in life. They're satisfied 100% by mama. However you spell mama. Okay. Little baby grows up. And let's just assume that this little baby, that his mother or her mother is really limited. You know, she's got some real profound psychological problems. And as these kids' needs increase, as they do for all of us, right? Life is more than just a bottle and a blanket and a clean diaper. It's more than that. I still want in the developing phases my mother to take care of me and meet these behavioral, social, emotional needs that I have as a growing baby. But let's assume, as I said, that my mother is psychotic. And all that poor little mother can do is to give me this much. That's all. She just hasn't got any more than that. So if my needs are 100% indicated by this line, and all I'm getting is this much, what am I getting? What percentage of my need?
10%.
Okay, that's a good guess. 10%. Now, there's a strange thing about little children. And I could give you all kinds of scientific studies, but it's a story I read in a paper someplace that demonstrate that when a child is not getting what he or she needs, who does he blame for this lack of getting what he or she needs? Okay. Themselves. No, themselves. Themselves. They blame themselves. Little 5-year-old beaten to death by her father. As she was dying, the paramedics were called in, came up. There happened to be a woman paramedic. She picked up this little dying 5-year-old girl. The little girl looked at her and she said, I'm a bad girl. I'm a bad girl. Little children, for whatever reason, blame themselves when they are not getting the approval, the acceptance, the approbation that they need. Okay? Now, most of us have had reasonably good parents, okay? But the thing that we have to learn is, before my mother is my mother, what is she? A little girl that touches me right here. That's sweet, okay? That's right, yeah, but that's not what I'm after. What is she as a little girl? What is she as a mature woman?
She's a person.
She's a person. Boy, that's hard to say. I really don't like you people. There's usually some in the group that says that my mother is my father's wife, and I would want you to keep that in perspective. I'm just kidding. She is a person. Now, the reason it's difficult for us to see our mother's person is why? Why is it so difficult?
It didn't start out that way.
It didn't start out that way?
It's sort of like the universe at the beginning.
Huh?
It's sort of like the universe at the beginning. There's just, you know, mother is everything.
Yeah. Isn't it difficult for us to say that our mothers have faults, limitations? They're finite. They have problems of their own. And their religious point of view, we know that most people have some debris in their subconscious mind, some crud that stems from the fact that there was some feeling of not being loved as much as they expected to be loved by primarily their mothers. So what I'm trying to teach people is to say, look, from the mother's point of view, for God's sakes, don't try to psychoanalyze your mother. That's the worst thing you can do. But from her point of view, this much is what percentage of her capability of loving you?
100%.
It's 100%. So when I go through the three or four key significant figures in life, who are mother, who else?
Father.
Who else?
Teacher.
Maybe a teacher.
Grandparents.
Your spouse. Now there may be a grandparent, there may be a brother, there may be an aunt, there may be, you know, somebody. Four or five people. So I literally, when I caught on to this methodology, I would stand in front of the mirror in the morning. I'd look at myself. I'd say, Mama loves you. Papa loves you. Martha loves you. Then I had to take a real deep breath and say, even Bishop Martin loves you. And that was very difficult for me to say. The poor guy is dead now, but still, huh? Yeah, I mean, he was really something else.
He might not like you, but he loves you.
Yeah, right. Well, I know. I don't know what that man did. But anyway.
John, is that why little children, when they're abused in school, they always think it's their fault?
Huh? Absolutely. And why they will defend their parents.
Oh, yes.
They blame themselves. There's something about in the quirk of the human mind, and studies have been done on that, that makes a little child blame himself or herself when they're being abused, maltreated, whatever else. So I'm trying to say to people, look, there's garbage floating around in our subconscious mind, some which we don't even admit to ourselves. You can help yourself a great deal by saying, Mama loves you, Papa loves you, your spouse loves you, your boss loves you. Now I've got a friend who I know loves me. Don't put your children in that category. For gosh sakes, don't ever expect your children to love you. We'll never do that. Why not? What will a little child do when it knows that you as the parent are dependent upon it for your sense of approval? What are you going to do? Don't take advantage of it.
Manipulate.
Manipulate. That's the word I'm trying to think. Thank you, David. Manipulate you. You know, little kids are better psychologists than all the psychologists put together. You've forgotten more about psychology when you're 5 years old than any psychiatrist will ever know. I mean,
that's how they get the bottle, the diaper, and the blanket.
Well, but those are essential. Yeah, but those are essential functions.
Well, I understand that, but you know,
it's the beginning of it.
The first thing you do is stick a bottle in. No, that didn't work. Okay, yeah. Maybe it's a blanket. Try that. No. Well, maybe it's a diaper. So you get trained.
Yeah. Okay. Whatever. Yeah. And children will take advantage of their feelings. No, you can't have an ice cream cone. Oh, an ice cream cone! They're standing there in the grocery store at 4:30 in the afternoon throwing a temper tantrum, knowing full well that you're going to give them an ice cream cone, even though it's half an hour till dinner time. That's just a silly example, but it's a good example. Don't ever look for your approval from your children. Now, my experience is that if you don't, later on in life you get it. Mm-hmm. Later on in life you get it. That's what it's all about as far as I'm concerned. Not when they're little monsters and you try to make civilized human beings out of them. So we find our self-love, I think, as we realize that within the limitation of the situation, and you don't know what your parents' limitation is, you don't know what your spouse's limitation is. My gosh, by the time you get married, you've lived 25, 20, 30 years, whatever it is. So, you know, your spouse's life has got a lot of history behind it that you don't know anything about. Within the limitation of whatever, I accept the acceptance. Makes you feel good. Frees you up to then accept other people. Johnny Cash is a beautiful songwriter that says all of this far better than anybody can possibly say it. Any psychiatrist, any theologian, any psychologist. Anybody have any idea where this? A Boy Named Sue. How do you do? Johnny Cash sang some great songs about human behavior. Great, great songs. Okay, here's this reprobate father, really reprobate, sorry. He leaves his home, he deserts his family, and he walks out the front door, he turns to his newborn little baby boy and says, "Kid, your name is Sue." There is never a birthday card, there is never a Christmas card, there is never anything. And so little Sue grows up with what feelings towards his dad? What do we do?
He hates him.
And when he grows up, the one thing he wants to do is find the old man and kill him. And so he finds the old man, and he beats him up. And the old man says, "Son, I don't blame you if you kill me, but before you do, I want to tell you something." And Sue picks him up, and he says, "Talk." This is what the old man says. Now, I'm expanding on it, but the words are in there. They're in Johnny Cash's song. He says, "Son, I know I'm sorry and no good. That's my problem. You don't know what my problem is. But when I left the house and deserted the family, I asked myself, what can I do for you, my son? And the thought occurred to me that in this lousy, rotten, dirty, no good neighborhood where you had to grow up, the only thing any daddy can do for his kid is to teach him how to fight. And boy, from the whooping you gave me, I'm a tough old man myself. You have received what I tried to give you." And Sue has this totally self-realizing experience that the act that he had considered from his point of view was an act of rejection. From the daddy's point of view was what? An act of acceptance and love. Now that's tough to do, but I'd rather come around in my life and work this through in my mind to where I have this self-love, even though my father and my mother did some horrible things. As far as I'm concerned, I thought they were horrible. I mean, what is it when the little kid comes home and he's got an older brother who's real brilliant, gets A's in everything, and I come home with my D's in math? It's all your fault, Philip. And here I come home with these horrible grades in math, and my mother invariably would say what? Yes, why can't you get A's like Vicky? Now what does this do to a little kid? You talk about, you know, I just soon get whipped. Now, I had to figure out in my mind that what I thought was sort of conditional love, boy, if I better get an A, she'd really love me. I'd never get an A in math. She'll never love me. So what I thought was a rejection, I had to work around and realize from her point of view, oh, if my kid could just get an A in math, he'd get to a better university, he'd have a better chance at a better job, and blah, 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 all this kind of stuff. Sure, she loved me. I didn't understand the time. So I just assume, you know, as a maturing person, go through this process and realize that, you know, mother loves me within her limitations. She was a wonderful woman, don't misunderstand me, but there's still crud in my subconscious mind that I have to get rid of if I want to be able to love you, because the crud doesn't allow me to love you. Okay, any questions on that? All right, now, let me do another thing on love.
Doesn't allow you to love because you're consumed with the thinking of it?
Mm-hmm. Right. To the degree that I do not love myself,
yeah.
I think about it, not consciously,
no.
But subconsciously.
Mm-hmm.
It hurts.
More in because it's already full.
Yeah. 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 And see, this kind of Christian love that we talked about, I mean, that's pretty all-consuming kind of an approach to life. I mean, there's no halfway about this. God's love, loving Gomer. Go marry Gomer. Go marry a prostitute, he tells Isaiah. I mean, that's pretty mature stuff. That's not kind of Christianity we got in America today coming at us from television screens. Doesn't even come from Billy Graham. That's another chapter. I'm going to go pass by. I won't pass by it. The reason, I think, one of the reasons, there's never one reason for anything, right? Always multiplicity of reasons. But one of the reasons I think America is in the emotional, the moral decline that we're in is because of Norman Vincent Peale and because of Billy Graham and because of Bishop Sheen and because of Joshua Lippmann. Because of all of those people. Why? Because those people taught that God is nothing but a cosmic bellhop. You go read Positive Power of Thinking. You got mother-in-law trouble? Four things you do and God is going to deliver your mother-in-law into your hands. You got trouble with your boss? Seven things. If you do these seven things, God will straighten it out and your boss will be wonderful. Your relationship with boss will be wonderful. And I'm not saying this too strongly. That's what is written. Joshua Lippmann was the first one who wrote a book back in the early 50s. Peace of mind. Well, how in the world can you have peace of mind in this world? You can have the peace that passeth all understanding. That ain't peace of mind. Every cotton-picking magazine and newspaper with a religious section on it you'd pick up, there'd be something about peace of mind in it and the power of positive thinking. And people said, well, I'm a religious person. I go to church and there's all this good stuff. And man, I said, I'm exploding. I mean, things are not working out for me. And the other event that happened in the early 50s was that a little pill was discovered. Remember the name of it? Miltown, first tranquilizer. So women would go to the doctor. People would go to the doctor. Oh, doctor, Miltown. What did our kids see their parents do? They saw our generation popping pills trying to get rid of our agonies. But what was wrong with us was we were fed a dogmatism that was not theology. Now, I know this is a radical position, but there's some truth in what I'm saying. And this crud that we have today coming at us over television, I mean, if that's Christianity, I'd just as soon be an animist. It's not Christianity. It has nothing to do with it. Nothing. They use the name Jesus, but that doesn't, you know, make you Christian. And Billy Graham is no better than the rest of them. He preaches half a gospel. Half a gospel. He preaches the gospel of salvation. He does not preach the gospel of righteousness and justice. And as I said in an earlier class, and I'm spouting off now, I'm going to take up an offering after this. If you think you're not an offering on this, you're all wrong. This is a pretty good sermon. Where was I? Well, who was I condemning now? I asked people who are devout Christian people. They said, why is it in the Bible that God picked Abraham to be the father of many generations? Why was Abraham chosen? People don't know. Don't have any idea. Let me see if I can find. I don't know where it is. It's somewhere. I can find it in my Bible. I can't find this cotton-picking Bible here. It's somewhere in Genesis. No, really. You know, you get used to your own Bible and got it down the line. And I think it's in Genesis 17, maybe 18. Somewhere along in there.
Because he followed his commandment to kill his son.
No, that's not it. I will tell it to you. I'll give you exact quotation. What the quotation says, it's somewhere, I cannot find it, that I have chosen him to be the father of many people so that he can teach his children the ways of righteousness and justice. That's why Abraham was chosen. That's why they are the select people. That's why we're the select people, to follow the way of righteousness and justice. And why do you think Amos and Hosea and Isaiah and Jeremiah, why did they get their nose out of joint? They got their nose out of joint because the priests were prostituting the religion. They made religious conformance with cultic practices to stand as submission to God's will. And they would say, no, let justice roll down like the waters and righteousness like an overflowing stream. Why in the world do you think Jesus was crucified? Do you think he was crucified because he made some statements about the kingdom of God and about a man's and a woman's relationship to God and the forgiveness of sin? Good gosh, no! He was crucified because of Matthew 23. Hypocrites, that's what you are, a bunch of hypocrites. Whitewashed tombs, on the outside you're clean, but inside you're full of hypocrisy. He nailed them because he spoke of justice and righteousness, and they couldn't take it any more than our society can take that kind of preaching today. I tell you what, I'm getting wound up now. No, I'm sorry, but I'll get back to my lesson in a minute. But you pay attention, you really want to go paying attention to me. I have, and this may be Austin, Texas, but I tell you, beloved, preaching in Austin, Texas is pitiful. It's pitiful. I'm talking about the Methodist churches, and that's my denomination. I'm talking about the Lutheran, I've gone with Ruby to her church, and it's just pitiful what goes on in these churches. It's just pap. It's just, you know, God loves you, and be nice, and go to church, and a little bit of stuff. And there is no confrontation. I mean, significant confrontation. There is nothing that says that our society stinks to high heaven, and our politicians stink, and our business executives stink, and I was a business executive the last few years of my life, and we stank in our company as to what we did. And there's no prophetic voice in the land anymore. That was different back in the days of Harry Emerson Fosdick, wasn't it? And back when the Nebus were holding forth. Back when we had big voices. Buttrick at Marble Collegiate, I mean at Fifth Avenue Presbyterian. These were men. These were men. People didn't like it, but they respected them. And today the Protestant pulpit is silent. So there's a vacuum, and these stupid evangelicals have moved in, and all that is just a cheap emotionalism. That's all that is. You confuse the voice with God of emotionalism. But anyway, let's talk about another thing about love. Now, it's an interesting thing that Jesus said in Matthew 22, and this is something we all too soon forget. You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your mind. Mind. Love is not an emotion. Not the kind of love we're talking about from a New Testament point of view. Why is it not an emotion? Because emotions go up and down. See, that's the problem with marriages today. For some reason, all my glands are working on all 8 cylinders and I feel good. Hey, I love you, baby. You love me. Wonderful. And then something happens. You know, whatever it is. I don't get enough potassium or it's the wrong time. No, really, I'm serious about that. You know, lack of potassium causes you to be depressed. Or it's the wrong time of the month. Or my boss chewed me out and my moods are down.
Yeah, you don't understand me. You don't love me anymore. Hell, I don't love you either.
Excuse my French, but I mean, you know, it's natural with me. And it just, you know, we go up and down. And love is not an emotion. Love is a matter of the will. Let me share with you how you get to Christian love. And I take it from a philosopher who has been condemned by the Christian church because they don't understand what the man is talking about, and who I think is more Christian than most people who claim that name. It's Nietzsche. Now, Nietzsche said God is dead, but you read Nietzsche, he talks about God all the time. Nietzsche has the reputation of not loving. He speaks about love all the time, but he does it in a different context. And when he said God is dead, what he meant, the God of the pietistic Protestants is dead in Germany. And that was a weird group of people, just like the televangelists are today. Self-righteous, pietistic, holier than thou. And he said, that God is dead. He never lived. He didn't talk about God the Creator. Nietzsche, in his great book, Das Beck, Zarathustra, he opens up with the 3 metamorphoses. He says, these are the 3 steps that you go through to, I think, finally wound up where you can love. Now, it's a little bit different language. 3 metamorphoses of the spirit
of the spirit. Here's a, supposed to be a secularist. He talks about the spirit.
Yeah.
Give me a break. Three metamorphoses of the spirit do I designate to you. How the spirit becometh a camel, the camel a lion, and the lion at last a child. Many heavy things are there for the spirit. The strong, load-bearing spirit in which reverence dwelleth. For the heavy and the heaviest longeth its strength. What is heavy? What is the first step in becoming mature so that eventually one might be able to wind up with some mature concept of love? What is the heaviest thing ye hear of? Is it not this? To humiliate oneself in order to mortify one's pride. To humiliate oneself in order to mortify one's pride. What jumps into your mind when Nietzsche says this? Do not the Beatitudes jump into your mind? The poor of spirit, the humble. To exhibit one's folly in order to mock one's wisdom. To show how dumb I am. So that I can mock whatever wisdom I think I might have. To negate the I. Or is it this? To desert our cause when it celebrateth its strength, its triumph. To desert our cause when it celebrateth its triumph. When people carry me high and say, John, you're a wonderful preacher. And they've said that. To desert the cause. Say I'm not. And to really realize that you're not. Or is it this? To be sick and dismiss comforters and make friends of the deaf who never hear your request. When you feel sorry for yourself because you're sick or something's happened to you and you want people to gather around you and pat you on the back and make you feel good, tell it to a deaf man. Take the burdens of life on your shoulders. Be a camel. Be a camel. Or is it this? To go into the foul water when it is the water of truth and not to disclaim cold frogs and hot toads. To go into the water of truth and not disclaim the cold frogs and hot toads. Or is it this? Now here is supposed to be a guy who's not a Christian. Or is it this? To love those who despise us and give one's hand to the phantom when it is going to frighten us. To love those who despise us, and when the phantom that frightens us meets us in life, to give it our hands and say, here I am. That's the camel. And I don't think maturity is possible until we understand what Jesus says in the parables, or what Nietzsche says in the first step of the Metamorphosis. Now, from the camel, you go on to become the lion. And here, Kaufman, who interpreted Nietzsche very well, helped me understand why the Nazis grabbed a hold of Nietzsche. Nietzsche hated the Germans. I mean, he was German himself, but he said the Germans are sorry people. I mean, they're just sorry. That's what they are. But Rosenthal, who was the theoretician of Hitler's theoretician, nobody, you know, Mysticism of the 20th Century is the book that he wrote, which really laid the foundation for Hitler's triumph and Hitler's philosophy. And they said that when Nietzsche talks about the lion, he's talking about the blonde Aryan race. And they completely screwed up everything Nietzsche said about the master-slave relationship, but that's another chapter altogether. But in the loneliest wilderness, there happened the second metamorphosis. Here the spirit becometh a lion. Lion, freedom will it capture and lordship in its own wilderness. What is it? Well, image here. What is the great dragon which the spirit is no longer inclined to call Lord and God? He says we're captivated by a dragon. And when we are able to say to this dragon, you no longer are my God, then we become free in the lion. And what this is, thou shalt is the great dragon called. When we feel under the compulsion to do something that we may not want to do, but we feel that we ought to do, that's the dragon that pulls us down. How many of us do things because we think we should? And when we do things because we should, you know, and we don't want to, that's going to put a burden on us, isn't it? I should do this for my wife. Good, you know, I should. You know, I'm a good boy, and my mama brought me up right, and she's an old biddy, but I should. Therefore, well, don't you think that that's going to play itself out in some other way, some transference that's going to come in, as Freud would teach us? But the spirit of the lion says, I will. The second step in the metamorphosis is that you no longer say, I should go to church. I will go to church. I should be kind to people I don't love. That never works out. But I will. Your will becomes the motivating force in the second step of the morphosis. This is the lie, and then you become really your own. And when you are the lion, then you become a child. And what is it the child does? To create new values that even the lion cannot yet accomplish, but to create itself freedom for new creating, that the might of the lion can do. To create itself freedom and to give a holy name even to duty. For that, my brethren, there is need of the lion. To assume to write the new values, for that is the most formal assumption for the load-bearing spirit and reverent spirit. Verity unto such a spirit, it is praying and the work of a beast of prey. As the holiest it once loved thou shalt, now it is for to find illusion and arbitrariness, even in the holiest of things, that it may capture freedom from its love. The lion is needed for this capture. But tell me, brethren, this is where it comes in, what the child can do which even the lion could not do. What hath the praying lion still? Why hath the praying lion still to become a child? Innocent is the child. And forgetfulness, a new beginning, a game of self-rolling wheel, a first movement, a holy yea. To be a child. Now, you see, you're free when you say, I will. You're free to say, I will to love. Not be caught in the emotional roller coaster of loving, but to be caught in the freedom to say, I will to love. I may be depressed. You may have, you know, given me a rotten deal, and you may not understand me, and my children may, you know, go off hog wild and out in left field twice removed, and my boss may not do this, and my boss may not do that, but as a little child, I now will to love, and there's the newness of life and the ability to see things from a different perspective. And I think this is very much involved in understanding the kind of love that Halleck and Jesus, you know, say that we need to have. We can't have it when we're still wallowing around in the oughtness of life, when we're still wallowing around in the emotionality of an understanding of love. We have to understand that love is of the will, that whether you feel good or whether you don't feel good, you will to love. And that takes a heap of growing up and takes a heap of maturity. Well, we didn't get to the second point. We're not going to finish this. But anyway, if you still can take some more of the stuff, I'll be tomorrow, at what time? 10:40, I think I'm on tomorrow. Thank you all so much. We'll see you. Any questions or comments, anything? Okay, I'll not take up an offering. I'll let you get on without that.